All meetings called to order, and the flag for this building is that one. First item is the pledge of allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, welcome to Paradise, the Fort of Kingston. And we don't have any public here, so there's no public comment. We'll get right into the interview. Do we want to just go over to Jim the sort of the ground rules and how we're going to go about this? And we can do introductions too.
Right.
I'm Walt Elliott. I'm current chair. I've been a commissioner for 4 years now.
I'm Mary McClure. I've just been a commissioner since January.
And I'm Bruce McIntyre. I've been commissioner for about 2.5 years.
Okay, and Jim, do you want to...
Yes. You all know me. I'm Jim Pavarnik, Executive Director, Samantha Berger. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for putting together such a good proposal. We were blessed with 6 proposals, and we decided that 2 of them were really what we had in mind. You listened, you got it, you put together a nice proposal. And at the end of the day, either one of the 2 companies, and I'm sure you compete a lot with Heartland, you know, you're both class acts. So I call this the dating phase and see who we want to work with, who we want to take to dinner, and really get your ideas above and beyond the single page that you put together as far as a proposal. So we put together 4 very broad questions to ask. And after those get asked, I'm sure the commissioners will have other interrelated questions within that category. So let's get started.
How do we want to go about it, asking questions?
So I was going to ask these questions,
okay,
and then you all will intersperse your questions
sure,
with
that's
that.
Right.
And the first has to tell us a little bit about your company and your team and how you want to move this thing forward.
All right. Well, our team is comprised of Property Counselors, it's an economic consulting firm, and Makers, it's Architecture and Urban Design. We've worked together, John and I worked together since at least 1980 when we did some work up in the Port of Olympia. But generally, we combine that sense of economics and physical solutions that I think lead to successful projects. John is a partner in Makers. I think read our proposals. Julie Bassick, a partner who is listed there, she's on vacation this week. John is, as I said, he's also a partner, and I've worked with both of them. They're both just outstanding consultants and well known throughout the region for the kind of work they can do. So, you know, the person who would ultimately work on the project, we would agree with you upon that, but frankly, both of them could do a top notch job. As I said, Property Counselors is an economic consulting firm who specialize in issues related to land use and facilities development. So, Property Counselors has been in existence for 30 years, and I was one of the founding principals of that. Prior to that, I worked for a national accounting firm as director of real estate advisory services in this region. I also worked for a regional economic consulting firm on the West Coast. Prior to that, I worked for an architectural firm and some of their economic consulting. And what I found was that by going to work for myself, essentially, I had the ability to get more involved in projects and had more fun doing it. And I think, frankly, the product was probably better as well. But I've worked with communities in this immediate area. I actually worked on a Port of Kingston comprehensive plan. I think that was probably in the early 90s. But I've also worked with the Olympic Property Group, doing some work out at Port Gamble, looking at activities that, that they could kind of stimulate there to increase the amount of people coming through and so forth. And I think look at what they've done over the last 10 years, a lot more going on there now than it was before. I worked with Port Gamble, Squallam, Indian Tribe, looking at some activities they could have on their lands around there. But I've also worked with waterfront communities throughout the area, Bellingham, and of course, Edmonds, Everett, Olympia, Seattle, Tacoma. Again, looking at property, looking what economic realities are, and looking at some potential projects that could meet the public objectives of those organizations. So I'll let John talk a little bit about some of those.
Sure. I'm a bit of a stand-in for Steve Bassick, who was the original proposer on this, and I think we can just talk about it, which one of us really takes the lead from an urban design standpoint. I've worked with Greg since like 1980 on similar kinds of projects where we're looking at how do you develop a given site or a portion of a downtown or a center or a waterfront and make it make sense economically. So a lot of what we do is provide a physical scheme, take a site, say, well, let's just posit a use on there or a couple of uses, and we'll draw up an architectural scheme and break and figure out what level of feasibility it is or what we need to do to make it feasible, for example. So we've done that in a number of cases, and sometimes Greg will support us, and sometimes we'll support Greg, depending upon what it is. My experience, I'm an architect, so I come from more of a design standpoint, and Julie is more of a planner, so she understands the planning. But we work for communities from Vancouver Island, Olympia, Port of Olympia, Port of Port Townsend, Port Angeles, all up and down the Sound our region, similar to Greg. I think our role on this project would be to handle some of the physical things, so that might mean coming up with some very schematic architectural plans that would look at different options. So we give Greg the raw data he needs to run the feasibility analysis, but also we're capable of talking to the county and making sure that figuring out what zoning might be necessary to do a certain thing, and thinking about how a process might work towards getting towards an RFP, for example. So we bring those skills as well. Involved in this project.
Great. Full disclosure, I have worked with both of these companies, so just so you all know that my vote doesn't count.
Oh, but it does.
And
experience counts for a lot here.
I can show you some experience later on. Yeah, sure.
Were you involved with a visioning process with the Port of Kingston about 1991, 1990?
We worked with the county. On a sub-area plan about 1990-91, which was a very contentious project, trying to resolve some growth management issues. That was right when growth management came out. So the county was trying to deal with the UGAs and urban growth boundaries and how big the community should grow and how many folks should be in it. And there is, as you know, in Kingston, there's a variety of opinions on that. So we tried to resolve that as best we could. And I think, you know, ultimately came up with a solution that's working. I was out bicycling along Barber Cutoff, the old family homestead, the other day. And I was, you know, it's really kind of working. Yes, we did that. And then the county later asked us to do design guidelines. Came back, because one of the things that grew out of that plan was people said, well, if we're going to have growth, we want to make sure it fits with the community. So we did design guidelines, and that was
so that was the Kingston, the design standards that we currently see that's on the website. It's not necessarily formally incorporated, but it's got pictures and it's got a lot of stuff. Okay, so we're familiar with that process.
The issue was how do you capture the, how do you make sure you keep the historical kind of waterfront oriented qualities in Kingston while, you know, allowing the projected growth. And I think that's an interesting issue here, I think. So we're able to do that. We're able to kind of very quickly come up with some principles that are would be necessary on whatever site to make sure it doesn't clash with the surroundings.
Well, question, when you said you worked out on this column, were you involved in the current project to develop a hotel on that site?
No.
No, that was before that. There was more planning before that project was. Okay. talk about two different people involved, and one would be Judy and the other would have the lead. And I'm just kind of curious, what would be the skill set or focus of the person who has a lead on the project? Because it could be economic, it could be planning, it could be architectural. I'm just trying to get what's the focus of that, or what would you be considering?
Greg would do the economics, of course, and be the lead, pulling all this together. And our firm, Makers, would support him. Probably if there's architectural drawings, I would do those schematic things. I can show you some examples of work that Jared and I have led in that regard. I think it depends upon what you all feel comfortable with. Julie can certainly do the coordination with the county, or I can do that, either one. But just what makes sense in terms of the commission.
Not to sell your firm, but the one thing that Julie is very good at is public outreach.
Yes.
So, I mean, she's probably the best I've seen. So if, in fact, there was a public outreach component, she would be the person that would run that.
She's got that personality that
This shouldn't be on tape, but I remember those sub-area plan meetings. It was like a Jerry Springer show. So you probably remember that, too. So that's an important part of dealing with Kingston. We're an opinionated bunch.
Well, I think that's right, and I think the other thing that that we could bring, and I'm happy to show you some examples, is the ability to illustrate what might be there. Because what we found, I think, most communities, including Kingston, is that once people could see what is being proposed and understand it, rather than in numbers or, you know, some kind of plan diagram that they can't understand, they're much more comfortable with it. So that might be part of what is necessary. Make sure that the community's on board with this, you know, particularly with the property there on a hillside.
While we're on this topic of sort of public outreach, how would you explain to a member of the public who is interested but not particularly sophisticated or particularly up to speed on what's going on, how would you explain to that person what you've been hired to do in terms of this curb grant?
Well, I think what we try to do is we want to identify a series of economically supportable uses for the properties. We want to illustrate what those uses might look like, and then we want to identify what the public benefits of those might be. So, based on that information, you know, you as a public body would have to make a decision as to how to proceed. But again, our job as consultants is to provide the information for you and your constituents to understand what your choices are.
So, in my mind, I think graphically instead of words. So, my image of what would be useful in this particular case is almost like a diagram that would say it, and it would list different options. So you might say, okay, let's take that central property. What would happen if we put a hotel there? So that would be maybe a site plan and Greg's analysis of its economic performance, but it almost also might be some visualizations of how it would fit in, how it would connect up to the walkways and the park and things. So people would say, and it would also include a description of what it would take to do that. Would it take rezoning? Would it take special effort or changes on a part of things? Would there be a transportation issue? Now, we can't get into all the details on all that, but we can begin to map it out. So in the end, I think both the port and the public would have a good sense of here's the options that we could do on these various sites, and here's the implications, both financially, visually, and in terms of the port's mission and what it would do for the community. So then y'all would have a chance to choose that, those kinds of things. And in my mind, I'm thinking maybe a little ahead of this, so great, cut me off, but I think when you start to think about going out for an RFP or
this is going to result in a partnership between the public, you, the port, and the private sector, because many of the uses you're talking about will require private investment and private management and operation. So we want to make sure that you have the information to understand what your role would be, what your contribution would be in terms of improvements and investment, and want to understand what the return would be, you know, directly in the form of revenue to the port, but indirectly to the community as a whole in terms of jobs and wages, salaries, and those kinds of benefits. I mean, generally, the port has a couple different missions, you know, according to its authorizing legislation. You know, one is transportation, and the other is economic development. And I think this probably falls in the economic development realm. And so we want to be able to show you what your options are, all within the context of what your mission is.
So we beat that one up.
No, Ben. That's a perfect segue.
Just another on what Bruce said, where we're going with that. Well, one comment is, ports in unincorporated areas have a little different mission than a port that's embedded in the city. So the public kind of expects us to have a bigger view than just this, what a typical port inside a city might do, because there's a city to do a lot of other stuff. So we get a lot of public input that, you know, the port has kind of a, not outside of Title 53, but that wasn't the question. The question was in terms of the land, the drawing and fitting of stuff in. There's a need at the beginning, I think, to get a grasp on the whole footprint. What are the needs of that whole footprint going forward? And it can be everything from parking to stormwater. You know, what is the big picture of the footprint? And then how does this specific site plan fit into that, those constraints and needs? Could you tell us a little bit of how you would go about assessing that aspect of the project?
Well, I think we would certainly start by talking to you, understand your current operations. Obviously, you've got a marina and all of the activities associated with that. So understand what you do now, understand what your vision is, and what additional facilities you might want to support that vision. And then, though, we might want to start looking at other opportunities beyond what you're doing now, because, you know, to diversify your role, I think, may or may not be appropriate. And so, as we identify and flesh out what those other opportunities are, then you can start to compare, for example, what's the value of, say, some kind of lodging facility in this area versus an expansion of your current operations. And as long as we can kind of flesh them out and identify what it means in each case, we can decide what you want to do. I mean, you could probably take what you're doing now, and you could probably find a use for both those pieces of property, but that may not be the highest and best use. It may not be what ultimately benefits the community. But we certainly want to identify what those uses associated with your current operation and take that into consideration.
Yeah, I think that that kind of strategic thinking is something certainly we want to make sure that we all have that discussion early on in the process. And so the question in my mind is, well, is that totally an internal discussion, or is that one that also involves community members? And we'll certainly follow your lead on that. But again, that's, I think, Julie's strength. She's worked with any number of ports to kind of do an overall strategic thinking on this kind of a thing for like Port of Port Angeles. It looks at the full array of activities and objectives within the port. So she's helped a number of ports out thinking through those issues before you begin to think about, well, how many slips in the marina that we need, or, you know, how big an industrial facility. So that, I think, would be something that she could really bring to the project if that's an important point of part of it.
I think it is a really important part of it. There has been a great deal of thought and discussion about economic development in this community, well beyond even what the port has involved itself in. And so I bristle a little bit at the idea of using design to sell ideas to the community or to not get sideways with the community, because I see that what we need to do to really fulfill our leadership role here is, in fact, to truly partner with the community. Mm-hmm. And that involves a kind of dialogue that is strategic but not a subterfuge.
Oh, yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that. I may have used the wrong word again, what I said. But the whole idea is to figure out what would make people comfortable. And, you know, like the design guidelines that we're working through, it's really involved the community to try to figure out. One of the first things we did was to go out and say, okay, what is it that's important? And we showed a bunch of pictures of examples and say, well, is this. So we had a good sense of what, you know, the public was really trying to achieve. So, yeah, absolutely. It's an inclusive process, not one that's trying to.
Yeah, and the design is meant to illustrate potential uses rather than to sell.
I think this whole process is going to push everybody out of their comfort zone at some point along the way. And I think if we do that and end up with agreement at some point down the road, that it'll have been well worth living through some discomfort. And so
that's not unusual. People fear loss, and change involves that threat. So we absolutely understand that people have to be comfortable before they move forward. But at the same time, I think it's important to demonstrate the benefits. I do think that these are both sites that where not only the port and its interests, but the larger community could be well served.
I don't think we're really talking about necessarily this being an update of our port strategic scheme, but rather a project plan for a subset of that. So we're not talking about everything the port does. We're really talking about how does this project fit into that, and focusing more on the project than should the marina be rebuilt and that sort of stuff. So I don't see that scope being bigger than the project, but you've got to consider, as you said, everything about that. And, you know, you've got pitchforks and torches when you build a project that it wasn't a good idea in the first place and would never get permitted anyway.
So this is a perfect discussion and a segue into the next one, because it's very easy to lose sight of who's funding this. And this is CERB, which is Community Economic Revitalization. So the end result here is job creation. So can you speak to us a little bit about your experience with CERB and preparing studies for CERB?
Let's see, the direct experience I have with CERB is on a LIFT project, the Local Infrastructure Financing Tool. And this was work with City of Mount Vernon to get funding for downtown improvements and waterfront improvements. And so CERB ran that program, and we had to demonstrate what the economic impacts were and what the revenues generated. So I understand their criteria, and I understand what they're trying to achieve. And that's kind of work that that I regularly do. Got several projects with the Port of Seattle now. We're looking at properties around the airport and looking at what the economic impact of development of those properties. So I have a model for economic impacts that looks at direct, indirect, and induced impacts, but looks at impacts on jobs, on personal income, and gross business receipts. So those are the kind of metrics that CERB is looking for, and we know how to get at those. I think what's interesting from my point of view is, to what extent does that restrict the uses that you can consider for a site? So, for example, CERB doesn't want their money spent on a shopping center. they don't want their money spent on residential development, but does that mean you can't do some kind of a mixed-use project that incorporates some of those elements? And I think you want to be open-minded enough to look at a range of things, but also recognize that ultimately we need to justify the project in terms of curbs objectives. So we can do that. We know what we're looking for, but we want to make sure that we aren't unnecessarily restricting what the opportunities are here. Because you've got some great properties, and simply the fact that curb will only assist in certain type of infrastructure investments. Obviously, they funded the planning study, but ultimately, looking for infrastructure dollars for them, you know, you think it's cheap money, but if it makes you pursue the wrong project, maybe that was very expensive money, and that wasn't the direction you wanted to go.
Good point.
But if we didn't, if that played out that way and we didn't seek curb money because we went a different direction, they aren't going to take back the grant money, right?
I don't think they take back the
not the planning
yeah,
money.
Yeah.
You know, as long as you meet the terms of the planning grant,
yeah.
Then from our point of view, we would certainly do that. Yeah, and we'll look at a range of uses, certainly including uses that the kind of uses they're looking for. And we might have some others that they're a little bit different, but you know, as long as you address those the kind of uses they like and illustrate the metrics that they're looking for, there's no problem with meeting the terms of the planning grant.
Yeah.
So I'm hearing you can do the analysis. It's got to be an honest analysis. It can't be say CURB only wants this type of businesses. Your answer may be, well, these businesses are not viable here. And that's okay in the study to do the analysis to find out, well, maybe it's not a CURB-funded activity. That's okay, we got the answer, we did the planning, but it doesn't invalidate, and you will keep your options open. You won't give us advice on something that meets CURB, it's not in the best interest of the board. That's kind of what I'm hearing you say, and that's good, because who knows? Your answer might be sell the property for all I know.
You're okay? So tell us some detailed experience of working on a similar sized project in a similar sized community. So small.
Okay, maybe John's got, I'll start talking about some work we worked together on in Edmonds, but I think. That is obviously they're your partner at the other end of the ferry run. There's some work there that I think illustrates some important points.
Okay. This is a project. I'll say it. Start. We were hired by the Port of Edmonds. I'll pass these around. They were trying to develop Harbor Square right across there, and wanted to make a pitch to the city, which the city ultimately rejected. Worry about you, but that's an unusual situation in Edmonds there. But so we assisted them, and Greg was part of the team as well. So we looked at the surroundings and talked about, you know, with the Port folks what they want to accomplish there in larger terms. Like you say, it's not just about this project, how does it fit in to the overall Port function and mission.
downtown waterfront, probably know the Kimberly Clark mill on the waterfront, closed down, lost 750 jobs, and Kimberly Clark was obviously interested in getting some money returned for the property. The city was very interested in replacing those jobs. So Kimberly Clark hired a commercial brokers to sell the property, but City of Everett hired us to, you know, kind of help them understand the range of uses that would be possible on that site, and also look at what some of the public interests might be in waterfront access and impacts on transportation. And then, you know, we kept in close touch with people from Kimberly Clark and their commercial brokers. But we ended up identifying some uses for that property that we thought were realistic, including shipyard operations there. Now, that may not be the kind of use you'd be looking at here, but it did represent a use that represented a tremendous number of jobs. And so that was important to the city, but also looked at it in a way that could also incorporate public access and promote public objectives. So I think there's some similarities to what you'd be looking at here. And on a smaller scale, I did some work at the Folsom's Resort out at CQ. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's a little fishing resort out there. And the Olson family was getting old. They wanted to sell their property. And what was the Cascade Land Conservancy at that time had an option on their property, and their hope was that they could find a user for the property that would maintain a lot of the community benefits. What was going on, first and foremost, being the economic activity, the number of jobs associated with the fishing industry. So we did a highest and best use analysis. We identified two different options for the property, one being just an upgrade, maintenance of the facilities they have out there now. The second was really an expansion of that facility as a year-round destination resort. So we did a whole market analysis, full financial projections, and looked at kind of what's the value of the property in those two scenarios, and made that information available to Chesapeake Land Conservancy. They were to take the next step, trying to market the property. But the truth is, it's a remote site out there, and we weren't able to put together, at least at that time, a proposal for 2008, a bad time to be marketing any property. So I think the Olsons are coming on, but at least we've given them some information to suggest what the potentials are. One thing just to say about the Edmonds project that John talked about, two lessons there that I think are interesting. One, from an economic perspective, if you've got a piece of property that has some existing uses on it, to be able to stimulate redevelopment, you have to allow for higher density than what's there today. Simply replacing existing buildings by some new ones, you're probably not going to generate enough additional value to justify that investment. So in the case of Edmonds, you have the Harbor Square business park there. So, you know, that's a one- and two-story development, and there was interest in the sports park in doing something new there, you know, but it was only by going to some higher density that would make sense. So that then gets into the issue of heights. But as I look at it, the board went through a process with city representation and, you know, it was really a responsible planning process, and then all activity on the council at that point. So the lesson is, you know, you've got to work with those entities that have the ultimate authority over it, and you know, until the last document is signed, anything can happen. So just be aware of it and kind of hold those hands as long as you can.
To that, in this process, would you interface with the county, or would you expect us to interface with the county on different uses?
I think we follow your lead, but we're certainly prepared. Both Julie and I have done a lot of work with municipalities.
just a comment there. Much of this property is urban residential zone. And then there's a slice of it. It doesn't follow the property lines. It kind of cuts diagonally across the property. So there would be some reconciliation with zoning. And we are pursuing the ports in Kitsap County are pursuing a port zone possibility with the county. So that's a very fluid thing. And maybe you could help us there, maybe not, but we probably need some technical support on how we go forward with that. Now, that port zone will not happen until they get their appeals process done with the current plan. So that's kind of a late fall thing towards the end of this project, but that could appear on the horizon that how do we take a proactive approach towards zoning that accommodates development, not that restricts it.
We took a quick look at the current zoning, and yeah, we understand that there's some concerns there. It seems to me what should probably happen is that we go through a process with you all on what kinds of things you might want to consider, and that would be a list. And then at that point, we could say, okay, well, here's what would be necessary to do with regard to zoning for each of those. And some of those you might say, oh, we don't want to, you know, that's off the table, but some of these might be. And then, of course, there are conversations with the county.
Rightly or wrongly, Kitsap County has somewhat of a reputation as being very difficult to get permitting through in a timely manner. Have you guys worked with Kitsap County before?
I've worked for Kitsap County and understand their foundation. I think you just have to kind of work, find out what the process is and go through the steps. But like I say, the first issue may just be zoning, and that's an even longer process than the permit. Then, of course, you know, on these properties, there will be the shoreline permits and all the other things that you need to deal with. That's something that should come out of the report as far as the steps and not your take.
As I mentioned earlier, there's going to be some kind of public-private partnership coming out of this. And so we want to identify what the port's role would be and what the private sector's role would be. And port's role, the first thing, obviously, you own the property, so you can make that available through sale or lease. And then the next question is, you know, what are the entitlements associated with that property? And so, you know, the port can get whatever rezoning is necessary for that property. Anything that pushes the speeds up the development process and makes the site much more attractive to a private partner. So you want to essentially get everything to the point where you can advertise for this property that where all of the uses that ultimate developer would want are all allowed, and all they have to do is go out and get the building. Maybe a little presumptuous in what the ultimate result of all this would be, but in a general sense, that's what the port's role in the partnership.
Let me go just a little bit different direction with another question that has occurred to me. We have a couple of issues that, for want of a better term, I'll characterize as wild cards. The first one is a passenger-only ferry election in November, which is, you know, midway through when the work is being done. And the second one is, I don't know, I don't have specific numbers, but a higher percentage than I had expected, say, of the downtown businesses themselves as well as the properties themselves are owned by people who don't live here. They may live in Edmonds, or they may live in Panama or Arizona or Colorado, but they don't live here. And given that, you know, there's an uncontrollable element out there, and B, there's an element that may change in midstream because we won't know until November 9th whether that passenger only ferry is going anywhere. Can you talk a little bit about experience you've had working with wild cards like that come in the middle of your study may change course or that they're out there and you just can't control them.
Okay, it seems like there are always wild cards. That's just the nature of the work. And I mean, in many cases, you'll have an election that might may change a 4-3 vote to a 3-4 vote. That can be a wild card. But, you know, the issue of, I guess, absentee landlords is one that we frequently deal with. And, you know, in most cases, you can kind of identify what their interests are. They're purely an investor in a property. If you can, you know, come to them with a plan that involves a better return on their investment, oftentimes they're very receptive to that. On the other hand, they may not have the same concerns about, you know, the community impacts in the short term. And so obviously that is a selling point for them. But at least if you can describe the economic opportunity, a lot of times those people are willing to participate in it.
Yeah, some of the work we do is what they call transit-oriented development, along with the, new light rail lines and stuff like that. And of course, you know, how many times have we been left at the altar by Sound Transit or Metro or some of the other transit agencies? So, in my mind, what you do is you have a list of things that are possibilities here. Some may be really dependent upon that passenger ferry, or some may not, but you keep your options open. So as you go through, it's going to take you some time to enable any of the rezoning and some of these other issues well past November. So you've got to keep your options open at least for that time and understand what the implications of the passenger ferry will be, and then adjust your. The other thing is, in my mind, even decisions that are made are not final decisions.
I think that's, you know, I think we probably a realistic way to look at this for me is alternate scenarios with a ferry or with not. With a ferry, could result in the development of a 700 unit development complex by OPG that's right at the borders of Kingston. We probably ran into that White Horse and all that. And without it, probably wouldn't, you know. And so there's two different worlds out there that we got to analyze for. And, but on your experience, Edmonds and was kind of a prosperous community. And we're in a situation where we have a lot of vacancies in downtown, particularly contingent to the area we're developing. So when I was in other government stuff, the idea was government shouldn't compete with the private sector. That was sort of a holy grail. So have you worked in other areas where you had to be sensitive to the impact the project would have on a weak downtown business district? In other words, you could drive them further under, depending upon how you do it. Have you had experience on how do you balance that within the return on investment of the project?
And that's interesting. That's where we're working on Five Big Mountain downtown Olympia. And that's exactly the issue. That a lot of existing businesses are concerned that some new development will drive them out of business. And the case we're trying to make is that new economic opportunities provide potential for those existing businesses to prosper. And in fact, they're already there. They're set up to be the first ones in a position to enjoy the additional patronage and the additional business associated with redevelopment. But it's something that we have to go through in many communities. There's a lot of businesses are just very protective of what they've got now. They feel threatened by any kind of change. And we just need to work with them enough to help them understand how things can be better rather than just words that things are going to get worse.
Yeah, or maybe just met with half a dozen officials from Olympia yesterday, Greg and I did, on this very issue, like you said. The strategy there will be to make sure that the local businesses are able to take advantage of the benefits that are going to come. So they're also, they haven't seen any, they were pointing out yesterday, they haven't seen any private investment, hardly except for one project in the last 8 to 10 years. So they're way on the bottom side of this investment. And so the point is to make their existing businesses stronger by using whatever comes out of this. So again, you have to look at if you're selling ice cream, that's your business. Here's how this will help it. Here's how it might take advantage. So you can have a sale in the evening or maybe this or that. But how you benefit from this is that being here with other people.
I'd like to go back to the passenger-only ferry conversation. For just a minute. I think the fact that we'll be starting the conversation in the community in the midst of all of the discussion about yes, passenger-only ferry, no passenger-only ferry, means that we're going to need to talk about it very carefully. I think it's pretty probable that the Port Commission is enthusiastic about passenger-only ferry, but obviously we can't assume that either everyone in the audience is or that, in fact, it will happen. And so that's something that I'm concerned how we play that as we go through the first, between now and November 10th, whatever the day is. I'd be interested in your thoughts about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that obviously, some of the information we present as part of the study could be viewed as part of some kind of campaign for or against it. We just have to be sensitive to that and make sure that very objective and even-handed information we present. I think I'm interested, maybe I can ask you, what, you've had passenger ferry in the past, the service, and I guess it was funded on kind of a provisional basis, and then when the funding ran out, the service stopped. But what were the lessons learned from the previous service, and how is that shaping what's proposed in the future?
Do you want that answer now, or is that something you need to study?
That's something we need to study.
Okay.
But I'm just curious, and I'll throw it out now. If it's a short answer, I'll listen to it, and if you want to leave it for another day, we can listen to it. But it's just a question that occurred to me.
I think the short answer, and we can get into a long discussion, but the short answer might be that the primary lesson learned was it's going to take substantial public subsidy to operate a system like that. And the proposal that's on the ballot this fall has a three tenths of a percent sales tax that would fund it. And that would be kind of the big difference between what
we were operating it. We got up to a 30% fare box, if that term means something to you.
Mm-hmm.
When we were running it, and they're projecting a 28% fare box with their funding stream. So the numbers work out. Now, the big wild card is how do you project ridership? The ridership projections are in a mature system, so they're hitting that 28% probably 3 years down the road. And because it takes people a while to decide to shift their transportation modes. So that's kind of the difference there, is you can't really run a transit system without a transit agency funding resources.
So we're down to about 5 more minutes.
Ooh.
So I guess the last question is, obviously we haven't had time to develop a scope of work or anything yet. You've seen our pitch, we've seen your pitch. But how would you envision starting this project out? What's your starting point?
Well, I think our starting point is always to kind of collect existing information and assess the current situation. So on the physical side, that means looking at the two sites and understanding their characteristics. On the economic side, we just look at the economic base of Kingston and the surrounding area of Kitsap County. So we do that before we start coming up with any alternative schemes. I think before we even do that, though, we need to kind of pin down the scope. We certainly need to pin down a public involvement process. You know, how expensive do you want that to be? It makes a big difference in how the dollars are allocated. But once that's resolved, then we can collect that existing information, and at that point you might have a first event or meeting, public meeting of some kind, just to talk to the people about what it is we're doing and get their initial sense. But really that decision on the public involvement, I think, needs to be hammered down
very quickly. One thing we've found very useful in the beginning when you start to announce the project and get out to the public is actually do a brief survey with that. Because people will read an announcement about a meeting or about a thing, but as soon as you start asking people questions in a survey, you know, whether it's online or in the newspaper or old school, people, you want to know something. And we can get some very quick, early information. We found these things are, in the past, the surveys without website stuff. Marginal use of what we're finding is that they're really now engaging a general sense of where the folks that respond are on that. So it's a good way to kind of let people know, but let them know that they're also we value their input, and I think they tend to show up at a meeting more if they've already got the parents. So I would suggest that, and I do think the real key is process and then the product. I think it'd be good to really understand what things you'll want and how far we go towards implementing this. Because there's a lot of steps that we're going to succeed in this effort. So how do we navigate those to give you the launch pad that you need?
Segueing off that, the true confession is before the meeting when I was hanging around, I hand out a list of deliverables, and the origin of that was at the commissioner's conference. And I mentioned to someone who was actually does kind of like what you do in Walla Walla, who's also a commissioner. I said, well, what? It was a question for the table. Well, what should we get out of this? What should we walk home with? What would be the wish list of deliverables to move forward on a project? And I don't really want you to go down the list, but I wanted to kind of get a sense for to what. Now, this is, we'll take divine intervention to get all this stuff. You know, that's why I understand that, but I'm just wondering to what degree would we be getting this type of information?
Well, I would say first that all of this information is exactly what you need through the entire process. But you're right, you can't get all of it in this current study. The things that occur to me, you know, in terms of cost estimates, really to get cost estimates, you need to do some engineering work, and that won't be part of what we do. You know, we can come up with some ballpark estimates just based on, you know, so many dollars per square foot of land area for some basic infrastructure, and that will get you a little ways down the process. But that, you know, you don't initiate a construction project without that. And obviously the partnership alternatives, we can identify a process for soliciting private developers, but we won't be able to, you know, initiate that process. So those are kind of, but again, I agree that this is kind of information, and we can address all of these things to some extent or another, but in some cases we'll just be taking the first step and there'll be additional work that needs to be done.
So if I can report on that real quickly, I think there's three things. One is this list of alternatives that could be done on the site. site, which are fiscal ramifications, what we needed for zoning, what the, how it relates to the city commission. So you'd have this array of information. The second thing is some recommendations for the next step in the process. Taking that out in time frames, who you got a partnership with, you know, what to do would be important. And then I think there's a third non-deliverable but very important product, and that is the goodwill with the community and the council. So, you know, we used to kind of always just say, oh, that social capital, that's a byproduct of our work. But I think that the social capital, that is how you would work with among yourselves, is actually a primary product. And so what we want to do is to build that, and that's not something that necessarily comes out on a piece of paper, but it builds a trust between the board, the community, and the county, and other partners. And including maybe the development community. You know, there might be an outreach part of this that would say, okay, what do you guys think? That would bring them involved and get them thinking about this.
Great. Any other questions?
One other. How would you anticipate the scope of work being developed? Would you anticipate that being a collaborative conversation?
Yes.
Okay. You aren't just going to go off in a room and do some magic and then give it back to us. So.
No. We can collaborate. Yeah.
Well, I have to say you did very well in the curveball we threw you by doing an interview in the middle of a playground.
But I like kids.
Good. That's a good thing.
Well, I think we might mention to Village Green that, you know, in terms of scheduling, a better soundproof curtain would help.
Yeah.
Well, we might be bothering them too.
Yeah, that's true.
Two sides of
it. It lifts my heart that you're
happy
kids. They're not screaming, and I haven't heard thumps. So.
Well, thank you very much. We are going to deliberate on trying to make a decision today. If in fact we do that, I will contact you and we can work on a scope of work, get a contract done for the next commission meeting, which will be the 24th of this month, and then start our project.
Very good. I'm not going to work for a while, so great.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. I didn't realize. Yeah.
Well, we'll make a break for the next group. Thank you very much.
You know, I was trying to connect. There was a court process in like 1990 or 91, and it was Ken Olson.
Oh, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Ken.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we actually, and I was part of that.
Are we all here? I guess we're all here. Did Michael leave, Sam?
Mike has left. He'll be returning.
Okay, because he left his coffee. But
he left his stuff. Maybe he's just...
Well, that bag is there. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. Well, thank you all for coming. I think you already know we're interviewing two companies, and you know Greg pretty well, as we all do. I think it's safe to say that you two are the best companies in the area to do this kind of work. So, and it showed in your presentations. Both of your presentations were above and beyond the others. So thank you for that. Thank you for a good presentation. What we're going to do today is go through four simple open-ended questions, and that will hopefully get some discussion going, and other questions will come out of that. But you've all had a chance to see our proposal. Have you been down to the property, so you've
yep.
been to the property, so you know all that. So I think we're going to start with, tell us a little bit about your company and your team you put together.
Okay, I'll do that. I'm Matt Anderson, one of the principals at Heartland. There are five principals. Firm's been around for 30 years, 32 actually. I've been with the firm for 17, so just about half of that time. Our firm was started as a land syndication development company, products all over the country, and through that experience, starting in the early 80s at Formant. And it was a very multidisciplinary office, so we had planners and developers, people of finance and law and architecture, because that's the nature of the work. We have to be able to cover a lot of territory and kind of come with ideas when we're doing kind of land development at that scale. When I joined the schools. We've got a combination of both, and finance, environmental sciences. All of those things kind of come together, and that's really what we're finding to be important for the type of work that we do now, for both public and private clients. Our work is, we have basically four big lines of business in the office. There's the civic, obviously, which is the public agency, advisory services. We do a lot of work with real estate companies and investors, so that on the private sector side. We also do work with what we call the corporate real estate side, but owner-occupiers of real estate who are not in the real estate business, but have a lot of real estate to deal with in addition to their operations. And then we have an investment side. So we started out as a land development company, and we still today have an investment side, albeit not in big master plan maintenance across the country. So the reason I raise that is it gives us a real broad kind of cross-section, both within the skills that the individual team members have, but you know, two-thirds of our work or more in a given year is on behalf of developers and investors. So in addition to the civic work, so we do have a really good sense for kind of what it is that the market needs, and we try to bring that to all of the advisory engagements, especially on the public side. We ask ourselves the questions like, would we put our money into this? How would we invest in this? And we're trying to make it pencil, but we're also trying to be very practical and realistic. Here's what we can make happen at this time to meet these objectives. Here's what we can't, at least under this construct. So we try to bring that to all these engagements so that we're helping people implement as much as study. The last thing that we ever want to do is be gives you a big fat binder that sits on a shelf and nothing ever happens. It's a study that's done either in an academic sense or in the abstract, but not really with the intention of getting done. So focus a lot on education. From a teaming standpoint, I'm the principal on the project. Matt Hoffman's been with the firm for
more than nine years,
almost 10 years, and is a senior project manager and really heads up our integrated analytics. So all of our big data analysis and a lot of the technology that we bring to projects like this is Matt's brainchild. And then Carson Gold is a research analyst within the firm doing kind of financial market analysis, site analysis.
How many employees?
Total at Heartland right now, 19.
And for this project, I'd be the main point of contact. I'd be the direct engineer. Matt's involvement will be very active throughout. We've got it kind of split out into, I'm sure there'll be questions about the approach, but it's generally baseline information, understanding kind of the current conditions. Carson will be leading that up. I'll be leading off the market analysis, assessment, feasibility, and that will then take the information, we'll all do it together, of course, we take the information, we'll have the implementation for this, that section. So that's kind of the division of labor, that's why there's the three of us here, negotiation, moving the project.
So, did I hear you correctly in that you have connections with investors that would possibly work with us to build this out, if it made sense?
Yeah. So like I say, the majority of Heartland's work is private sector, and it's we represent equity, place equity, we syndicate and place equity in projects, infill projects in the Puget Sound. We represent institutional investors in some of their strategies that go beyond the Puget Sound, and we do work with developers of all types on a whole variety of different types of engagements from their own business model. We're doing work with the property group right now, have been for a couple of years, both at their assets and at their kind of strategic level as a company. So we were just talking on the way over, we were thinking about hotels and thinking about how do you get up underneath a sub-market that it doesn't have a lot of information. You know, you can easily glean from the market itself. We were thinking, we know people that are in the hotel business that are actually not far away, would certainly know this, and they can give us their quick read as to kind of like, here's our sense for what it would take, you know, to make a hotel over here. And that's where, when we do market analysis, that's a big part of what we do. You know, a lot of it is outreach, especially when we're talking about something that is, it's not obvious. This is the low-hanging fruit. It's an office building built tomorrow. You know, So if we can't prove it to ourselves, then we have to keep working. It's not, you know, it's, if we couldn't prove it and convince others, then we're assuming it's either not ready or we're not thinking about it.
Any questions?
It's interesting to talk about hotel. Our retail business community likes that idea because you talk about the dollars return per night per stay. On the other side is we have two casinos. One's, I think, increasing their capacity by about 50%, and one's building a hotel as we speak. So there's an issue of whether the market is there, what are the beds demand, and of course it depends on the business model of the hotel.
Yeah.
But this leads me to, if your experience in assessing the business risk of proposals, I hope I got the right words there, but something can seem like a really good idea, but like we got a little ferry set at the dock here. So we got to have some, what's your experience in not only coming up with ideas but or proposals, but assessing the business risk associated with those?
So when the proposals come back,
when we say, okay, I got this alternative. This is a hotel. This is a restaurant. This is a rendering factory. Whatever, you know. And well, what's the risk of that business actually being established and being successful compared to not? I hope I'm answering that right. But if we're going to pursue an option, we need to know how feasible would be risk associated with that option, not just what it returns.
Right. So I would break that down. It's really two steps. Probably a round robin. Yeah. It starts with the market analysis piece, and then it always goes to the financial analysis. So to us, you know, the market analysis gives you the inputs to the financial model, and then you have to prove it effectively in the financial model. Like, how's this going to work? And then in that financial analysis, a lot of it relies on, hey, this is a, so a hotel's a great example. Hotels are operating businesses. It's real estate, but it's much more, it's value. When you're doing evaluation of an actual hotel, there's much higher risk in the operations because it's all about, is it a good operator? Is it good food and beverage? You know, what kind of restaurant is there? What kind of segment of the market is it? So it's much more than just an office building, which is a more straightforward piece of real estate. So the discount rate or the risk that we associate with a hotel operation, it's higher. And so that comes through both in the market analysis, but also the financial analysis. And that actually you can prove out in the data itself in terms of sales of hotel projects. You'll see higher cap rates or, you know, hurdle rates, if you will, for hotels than you would say other product types. Also, when you're talking about something that is very specialized, so it's user-driven, the way we help underwrite that prior to going out and saying getting true responses from operators is to go talk to those operators and really kind of suss out, you know, and that's definitely a part of this engagement, at least for our perspective from market analysis, talking to people and saying, let's talk about Kingston. And they Kingston might not be on the radar screen, but we want to talk about Kingston and see what their take is on different types of uses. And we know those developers who are really good at what they do, and they'll give us this great answer. We did that with Bellingham a lot. So the big Port of Bellingham waterfront project, you know, Bellingham is a tertiary market, you know, so there's always long been this sense that why not Bellingham? Why can't we check out a university? You know, we're not that far away, we've got Vancouver right there. And so we did talk to a lot of different developers. It's like, you know, ask the question, get that feedback. That was all prior to going to market and getting full responses. So we didn't want to be surprised by a lot of what we're hearing. We also didn't want to raise expectations for what could be done with properties. To shape something that was very realistic, and ultimately did find a developer. We had to go all the way to Ireland to do it, but we found a developer who's moving through phase one project now. So I hope that answers.
That does answer my question.
I saw in the paper the other day that Heartland had been selected to administer a Curb Mining grant for Bremerton.
Yep.
Are any of you involved in that? And I don't know how far around the track that is, but do you have a perception of what would be the elements from that that could be piggybacked or borrowed, and what you think would be, you know, different and unique here that you couldn't just transfer it over from from Bremerton and apply it to Kingston?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah. Maybe I'll just throw out kind of the crux of that. Yeah. Matt and I are both neck deep in that, leading up that effort with one of our other colleagues as well. So the Bremerton's really, Jim Rothman at Bremerton's bringing like a lot of new energy to the whole thing.
He drinks too much coffee.
So yeah, so we started having these just like periodic phone calls where we were just kind of talking about stuff, you know, what's going on with the board and what his challenges were. And as we this was a while back, this was long before the CURB grant effort even started. And really his challenge was he's still trying to figure out what the story is and who to tell the story to. So his challenge is like, what's our competitive advantage? How do I truly bake that? And then how do I tell that story to the right people? He kind of felt like he's just kind of talking to everybody and saying basically the same thing that every other port district, but every other industrial landowner really is saying to them. Like, hey, we've got inexpensive land and cheap power and well-trained workforce. I mean, a lot of people say that. And that it's he was kind of struggling with, we've got to be different somehow. We're not on the I-5 corridor, and we're not going to be, so we have to tell the story in a better way that shows how we're competitive, and then we have to be telling it to the right people, because if you're just broadly putting ads in various trade publications, it's just Bremerton's got a big airport, you know, there's a lot of people like that around the country, and it's not very useful. So the crux of this study is, we're calling it competitiveness analysis, but it is going to create from the dirt, from the land you've got, it's going to create a business case for a range of hypothetical users. So take someone who is airport oriented, maybe they're repairing 737, you know, or some sort of aviation group. Take their type of business, their type of employees, the type of footprint that they would need physically, and maybe take someone like marine boat manufacturing that doesn't have to go in the water. And maybe it's a third group that's in green technology or wind turbines. As a category, and we're going to show kind of from the ground up what is the business economics look like, and then we're going to actually go out and find those groups, and we'll see and compare it to other properties, not just port-owned properties, because you know we're in the site selection business on the private sector side, and if it's a port property, that's great. If it's privately owned, that's also probably great, depending on the property. So comparing it to other places and saying, okay, here, Jim, here's how you stack up against Auburn, Kent, Sumner, Moses Lake, you know, kind of picking those kind of examples. So that then he can go out and say, oh, okay, I'm very competitive with these categories. I'm not competitive for these, and I should focus my attention and my limited resources on getting to these types of people. And then telling them this story, which is much more compelling than we're like everybody else. You should come from. So
it's more industrial focused, though.
Yeah, I was going to say it's very industrial focused.
The methodology, though, is really similar as far as, like, bottom line is, what's the story, who's the target market, and how are we best going to be able to reach out to them and you know, sell why they come to the Port of Bremerton district. The same is true here, except it's not industrial and it's more on the, you know, jobs that are more service related, potentially maybe some office jobs, but it's around the ferry activity, we'll call it, the ferry oriented development. So where the competition for Bremerton might be, you know, Kent Valley or Sumner. Here it's, you know, what are other ferry dock areas doing? How are they performing? What's working for them? What isn't working for them? And learning from those. So there will be some aspect of case studies. You know, the obvious ones are Edmonds and Bainbridge Island. But, you know,
Bremerton's Waterbridge.
Yeah. We'll take a look at some other ones. Some other ones as well. But as far as to your question, you know, can we leverage some of this work for the Port of Bremerton to Port of Kingston? I'd say yes, because we'd be looking at employment. So at the same time as we'd be pulling the information for the employment, you know, focusing on the industrial jobs, may as well grab the data. But my theory is, if you've got an information set, you may as well get as much out of it as you can and then parse it as you need. So we'd also grab, you know, retail, you know, service jobs, restaurant jobs, just to understand, you know, part of the CURB grant is, you know, the number of employees and the types of wages you might expect from employees. So, you know, just kind of understanding, making sure that we cover the requirements of the CURB grant, we'd be using And it also plays into the feasibility model as well, you know, as far as absorption. One of the data sets we use is job projections. So they're estimating the jobs to be in 10 years for a particular sector. That's always risky, especially when they don't know that a fast ferry might be coming in online in 2018. You know, that obviously would change the dynamic of employment and household formation. So you take all those projections with a grain of salt, but we'd be able to at least get that baseline information all at once. Matt and I were talking about this on the way here. We're about to pull the employment data. Like, well, we may as well just get it for Kingston just in case we have this opportunity to work with you all. We'd be ready for that aspect of the investigation. Same with we're looking at using reuse CoStar for our market data. We at least have to have a baseline understanding of market trends. Source we use largely for looking at market rents and vacancies and things like that was CoStar data set. So we, at the same time, we're pulling information for the Burlington job would be also grabbing information for up here.
So, talking about the passenger early ferry potential that we'll all know about just about the time we're ready to be drafting a final report, right? How do you see handling that, particularly as we go and talk to the community?
You mean the kind of what's the potential with and without?
Yeah.
If it passes and it doesn't pass. I think by product type, I mean the real estate itself, it's got property boundaries and it's gonna, there's only so many different ways to put different product type in there. So at the outset, we be coming up with a lot of different, what's the total range that we can think of putting in the physical space? How would it stack up? And what are the kind of challenges with that? Then I think we would ask the question, what is the potential benefit of having a ferry? Is it a game changer for any one product type over another? And we would want to highlight that the best we can in the study so that we kind of have a sense for, hey, here's what we think it would be today. Here's how we think that would be different. Hold the dock in 30 minutes. And some uses, that's going to be a real plus. And others, I think it might be kind of be nice to have, but it's not necessarily going to totally move the needle. So
I would add to that, Matt, I've been having a fun time brainstorming about the possibility because it is unique and historic at the same time because it takes us back to old Puget Sound. One of the processes we go through is we establish what the baseline is by product group for each of the different uses that Matt was saying for alternatives to the site, but then we would be able to add a potential lift that would add to each of those uses using case studies of where ferry-oriented development or fast ferries have been implemented successfully around the world too, because there are examples of that in other countries and around the United States. So Manhattan's a perfect example of that, from Hoboken to so different demographics in New York, but you could try to quantify what that lift looks like and adjust it accordingly above the baseline. So that's the analytical process we use.
Yeah, and back to the baselining, we want to take a lot of time working with reaching out to not only getting information that you guys have done on studies and understanding the case study, probably with the transit authority to understand what studies they've done on the fast ferry, to understand the number of passengers they project and the impact it might have. I mean, you think about the parking impact it might have. That also kind of plays into the whole thinking of the jigsaw puzzle that is downtown Kingston. The parking's already, there's ample parking right now. I think there's an appendix, I think, that talks about parking and transportation. I didn't get a chance to see it, but I think there's some studies that we've done this. We need to kind of look at that and try to understand how the fast ferry might impact parking demand, because that can play into these sites as well.
We were also thinking of there's almost kind of a diffuse scenario where the fast ferry is creating an opportunity outside of this kind of immediate environment right around the harbor. The idea being if it's real and I get a 30-minute ride in, maybe I move here and I just now it's commutable. Maybe right now, I don't think it's commutable, but suddenly it is. Then the question I'm wondering, putting my kind of residential development hat on, is well, where are the subdivisions going to start happening, and how close are they going to be to here? So is there a way we can project a population increase? So that means that the population increase then creates the economic environment around the harbor. The ferry itself is driving more people, but then the properties reflect that impact by maybe it's new commercial. And that's because the population base increasing over its historic past, not so much that the ferry has some specific connection to that use. So it could be kind of, we have to look at it both ways. So I would also want to know, in that with ferry scenario, how much developable land is there for single families? I think people would move to Kingston, but they would want a single family house, and if they're going to be in this type of environment, I think they probably want that kind of space and the easy access to the city, which is what people like Bainbridge for. But it's clearly going to be less expensive than Bainbridge. So there's kind of a corollary, I think, there to be explored.
This is an exercise that we do commonly through light rail as well. You've got this vein of transit that runs, and you've got stations, and this would be very indicative of what a station would look like. And so you always want to consider the parking ramifications, population increases, commercial infill, things like that. So this is something we've done a lot of, talk about quite frequently.
Just a comment and a question.
Yeah.
One of the comments is, the people who study residential development in Kingston ad nauseum is OPG.
Yeah.
And so you might have access to that information. They've been in the market for 2 decades now on their Arborwood project. So
yep.
They probably have the best feeling for that. But this is a different question. This project is on a site which is in the context of a whole port. Mm-hmm. And the issue is in developing this site, we need to see what are all the needs for the port going forward for all the functions that we perform, or what the community expects of us, and how do we consider that in the recommendations? And I'm just kind of interested in, and that's kind of a planning, more business than a planning, more planning than a business thing, and I'm kind of wondering how you go about doing that.
So maybe just throw in a couple of things that we observed. You've got a lot, and this is common. We experienced at the Port of Seattle almost a decade ago when we did the harbor development strategy with them. Is that they've got some uses and some constituents that really depend on the facilities they provide. Even basic things like a parking lot for boat trailers. Well, it's a big deal. I have a place to put my boat trailer, and this is the boat launch. I've got a problem. And public agency, that's your problem. So that is one opportunity. So there's the development of places that are currently serving those needs. We have to figure out, okay, what's the cost of displacing that, and what's the functional impact to the port customers. And I think that's probably what you're getting at in terms of a variety of different groups. And they all count. It's not just about development. For the sake of development, it's got to work for the whole operation.
It's about a whole business.
It's everything. It's like, what can we do with this property? Well, if it incurs a cost, and not to oversimplify, but in our minds, that everything is a revenue or a cost in some fashion. We're trying to figure out how to balance this mess. It's the jigsaw puzzle. That is, okay, if I have to move this parking, but I still need the same volume of parking, then I have to put that in, and I need to create development capacity, then I need to put that into some sort of structure. Definitely incurring a lot of cost. So then the question is, well, how am I doing with the revenue side? Is that freeing me up to create enough revenue to cover that? And is that worth doing? Is it worth doing for the port? Is it worth doing for the port plus a private sector partner? And how would that work? And that's kind of our thought process on all of these things. And that could include infrastructure. I mean, some things are just capital investments that you're going to make because it's part of the port's strategy for its harbor. Other things are things you're doing to yourself. You're choosing to displace this and therefore incur the cost. So you better find a way to pay for that, one way or the other. So we're always trying to see how much can we leverage the real estate to cover those operational facilities. And at the end of the day, are we net better, or did we just put a lot of money into getting the same thing?
I think in our case, given how many boarded up storefronts there are in Kingston, and the opportunity for whatever happens on the port site to have repercussions all the way through the downtown. How would you handle that sort of factor?
So I was thinking, so it's looking for uses that are complementary. Thank you. So we say complementary to the existing businesses that are on there. And yeah, I mean, you want to see the Complete Streets study did a great job of showing potential catalyst sites, and these are some of them. You want to make sure that these sites do prove to the market that you can be successful and fill these spaces in. Right in here, and I'd like to learn more, that there has been some historic outreach to restaurants, trying to attract restaurants to this area, but that hasn't necessarily been outreach to other retailers, traditional retailers. Like, one of the ideas we're thinking of for retail was, you know, what kind of retailers would go on here? Well, you got all this food traffic coming to the Olympics and going to other water activities in the canal. Provisions, those kinds of things, not just like conveniences, but maybe the hiking gear and more, those kinds of retailers, so they've been approached. They're not currently in the downtown, so just thinking through those gaps, I think would be really beneficial. So whether or not that gets on to one of these two sites or not, just advancing that thinking, I think, would go a long ways towards not only these sites, but also just enhancing the
Yeah, we're not, and when we do a study like this too, it's, you've got some specific properties, they are the subject properties, but as Matt says, there are other properties. So we may find a use, say, Cottonwood Hotels. We say, we think there's a real up and coming demand for, say, a limited service hotel, or maybe it's more on the higher end boutique hotel with spa. We think there's a real opportunity for it, but we look at your sites and we're trying to figure out how does it fit right here. The answer may be it doesn't fit here. It doesn't really work here, but what we've known just from our investigation thus far is that there's opportunities elsewhere within just a few blocks where we could see that site. So, and when we work with ports, we often say, hey, look, if you don't have to do it on your property, then the opportunity can happen someplace else nearby, then so be it. That's a win as well. So sometimes we find that we're finding a better site, that is more conducive physically to the use that we actually identified when we were starting the investigation of subject properties. And then we say, wait a minute, what happens if the boutique hotel with spa goes on this site? Then you've accomplished the same goal in the submarket, and then what can we do? Like, what's our next thing? Say, well, we could go with a seasonal amphitheater, because that's a use that nobody else can do, but our site uniquely can. Or, whatever those events might be. We say, oh, well, that's something we can do, with our property, given our natural constraints, whether it's parking or infrastructure or whatever.
At some point, we're going to have, a public input segment to whatever we do. So I'd be interested in how would you explain in simple layman's terms to an interested but not particularly sophisticated or up-to-speed member of the public what it is you have been hired to do under this CURB grant? How would you put it to them in a way that anybody can understand?
Yeah, that's a really common aspect of the project for us. It's presentations and input graphics. We use a lot of graphics actually in our office. We have one of our 19 people is a graphic artist. And we take her stuff, tear her sketches on paper that don't make any sense. And she translates a lot of that stuff visually. So a lot of times we'll take the financial models, for example, and we love a good financial model and dig into the spreadsheet, but it doesn't translate into presentation. So we'll turn that stuff around. So when we're doing, say, findings from the financial model, we'll create a whole series of graphics to show kind of it's this part, and then it's this part, and then you got to get above this line, and then here's what this looks like. And a lot of times people never considered the development economics or even market economics in that way. And they say, oh, I get it. Like,
feasible. And then we'll show scenarios A through C, and here's what happened with each one, and here's why. And sometimes we present that rapidly, and it's really compelling. So that's the way to get kind of the some of the findings across. There's also just the desire to kind of engage with the community in the investigation phase of the project, which is, you know, here you can't really substitute your outsider perspective. I mean, sometimes you just have to talk to as many people as possible and say, okay, what about this? And just be open to that, you know, back and forth. And hear what people, you know, especially retailers, for example, you're talking about downtown, and you got to hear from the restaurateur, you got to hear from the shop owners, like, hey, what's the big challenge? Some things are working, some things are just not working. And what's your problem? You know, what can be solved? And sometimes they'll say, it's too much vacancy, no parking, because that is, you know, common, traffic is all passed through, nobody stops, you know, these types of issues. And those are the things you want to hear. Not just do the meeting to check the box, but you really do need to hear. And if we don't get them, because we don't make a public meeting, at least from our standpoint, we're going to end up talking to them at some point or another, whether it's sit in the diner or something. So it's, you really do have to know their issues.
Let me refocus that a little bit. So you're walking down the street, and one of these retail shop owners comes out and says, I hear we're paying you $40,000. What are you doing?
Yeah, so there would have to be an elevator pitch, right, that we have to simply state it. In my mind, it's fairly straightforward in the explanation. You know, we're discovering, we're identifying opportunities, and we're helping create the path to implement those opportunities. Why does it cost so much? I guess would be a follow-up question. and in the scheme of things, if you look at the... Well, first of all, it will take a lot of time and effort to do all three of those phases, the discovery, meaning the baselining, the opportunity, the market assessment, and highest and best use, and perform the work in the implementation, the how we're going to get there, the roadmap to get there. It's, you know, we've got, I think it's through December to get this done. It's a time-intensive effort, so that cost is commensurate with the work that you're in and the output you're going to get from this. But the idea is, you know, Mr. Business Owner, we're doing this while these properties are on Portland properties. The idea is that these are two catalyst sites that are going to help continue to activate and enhance the Kingston downtown. And so the purpose here of the CURB grant is to encourage economic on these two properties, but again, the board's mission is to serve the district and enhance the district. And there'd probably be some nice graphics that we can put that.
So let me spin off on Bruce's question a little bit. You know, one way I would answer that, not is this is more than just building something that works as a business. This has to deal with adding value to the community. And there's a lot of those aspects that if you purely wanted to do a business study, you wouldn't have to spend money on. So we've got a bunch of audiences out there. We've got people that live in the double wides out a distance away. We've got wealthy retirees. We've got the neighborhood residents that are right along there who will be the neighbors. So the question is, how do you work that into the process besides just the downtown business folks? That's important. And they probably had a biggest stake. But how about those people with other stakes, the other stakeholders in this project? How do you outreach? How do you normally outreach to those folks? Is it proactive, reactive?
It's definitely actually proactive. I think most often we put ourselves in their shoes, like how would we feel? How would I feel if I was told, hey, just the study we've done, you're not going to have any opportunity to really speak up unless you show up and make a big stink. So it has to be proactive. A lot of times we'll do an open house style because we have a lot of one-on-one conversations that way. We'll set up boards, you know, depending on where we're at in the process, and talk about kind of what are the challenges. Sometimes we'll do a transportation board, and sometimes we'll do a market board, identifying specific uses. The information that kind of helps that you can point to and talk to, and then really collect feedback. So and by constituent, if you will. So. Who is the, what are the neighborhood residents saying about their neighborhood or their primary concerns, and what do they see as the opportunities in a similar way for the business owners. You take all that stuff back and kind of map that over and understand, hey, this is what we're hearing from people. I think a lot of times people don't think about the community outreach piece as the idea generation phase. But for us, that's a big part of it. I mean, nobody knows this better than the people do. We can apply our outside perspective and expertise in the real estate development realm, but we cannot substitute for somebody who gets their coffee there every single morning and spends all their time there. It's impossible to do. So we always think about that as really an asset. So this is about talking to people about their hopes and dreams and how they translate to this place. And for me, I think it's the opportunity to get a lot of ideas. And then our job is, in some ways, to translate those. It's not to say, yeah, you can have everything you want, because there's reality to that. And that's a big part of our job. But it's to be open to all of those hopes and dreams and then translate that into something like this. That is a brilliant idea. And actually, we think there's a way that we can get that done here, or on the adjacent sites, or in sub-market, or over the next 5 years. How can we make those things? And to be straight with people, we're not going to get a 10-story steel building in the next 10 years.
And just a real quick add on to that, we want to use information that's fresh information that's already been collected. And I know there was a survey done for business owners and property owners, and it was like a 6-page output that kind of summarized. I'd like to learn more, get under the hood a little bit, talk to the folks that did that, and use that information as a baseline as well to kind of understand where the business community and visitors community are coming from.
I would add also, I'm a cyclist and I like to bike through Kingston over to Indianola and the Bay Bridge. And so if I hopped off the ferry with my bike and someone said, hey, you work at Harwood, what are you guys doing around here? What are you working on? I would say we've got this mantra in our offices on the wall. It says design inspires community. But you can't have community unless that design process is collaborative. And that would be something we would definitely focus on. And then once you have community, you have economic investment, and then you have jobs, and then you have vitality that comes from that. And that would be a process that we go through. One other piece of outreach that we commonly do, Matt mentioned CoStar is a way that we aggregate a lot of different real estate sales data, lease data, and things of that sort. Well, to take that a step further, we also pull data from assessor transactions, and then a lot of times that involves calling brokers specifically to talk to them, because they are right on the front lines of the transaction flow, and they're hearing what the interests are of potential investors and acquirers, and that puts us right directly here on the ground. Brokers have opinions left and right, so we get that flow, which is very, very important for us.
Yeah, we know in the approach, the market perception. We'll tap into what the market's perception in this area is as well. Brokers are more community than we talk to.
That's here and elsewhere too. It's important, especially when we're talking about the kind of disruptive potential of a fast very positive.
So we only have 10 minutes left, and we're not still on the first question.
Oh, no. All right, lightning round, go. Let's go.
There's just a couple things we really want to touch on, and one is we've kind of danced around CURB, and we all know what CURB stands for. So we kind of want your experience in working with CURB, and if you really understand the ramifications of working with CURB and what they're going to want.
Yeah.
You were just in the meeting, so.
Yeah. So our experience with CURB thus far has been the pursuit with Bremerton. We were able to write the scope and pursue that piece of it. And it really does, at least in my view, it comes down to economic development. This is about it's about jobs, as it is with most ports. That's the top line. The work we're doing in the Port of Seattle right now, it's not CURB funded, but it's very, very, very similar. Outlook. It's about economic development. It's about jobs, and that does translate in a lot of cases to the real estate itself. It's this their hoard, Port of Seattle case, residential. That's not a thing. We're not looking at that. I'm trying to figure out how that's helpful. I think in this case, it's probably on the list in some fashion, given the nature of the location. But it does come back then to doing that economic impact. So I have rooftops here. What's my sales tax. I get a whole variety of other taxes. showing the state that this is money well spent and how it's ultimately going to play out. And they review, and I was there with Jim Mocker, who made a pitch to the Kern committee, and a lot of it is telling them, you gave us this money, this is what we studied. Not only is, here's what we found, and here's where we're taking it as a local jurisdiction, but here's what it means for the other boards. So really getting the point across that this is, there are transferable things we'll learn here, and I know that Curve wants to, they feel real good when they hear something here, and then they feel like, wow, we helped the Port of Kingston, you know, move forward with some specific things, but we're also helping the Port of Walla Walla, who has some similar tourist-related questions, and there's a lot of transfer of knowledge there. So I think that that statewide focus should be part of it. And that's about how you show the findings, at least in my opinion.
And then the nuts and bolts of it. I'm sure there's reporting, monthly reporting you've got to do to your grant administrator. On other public projects we've worked on that are grant-related, I mean, we've supported the client in, you know, with that reporting as well. You know, like the progress reports, and where we are on the budget and all those things. I mean, those are just part of doing business with clients that are supporting the work of grants.
And I would also say in the research wheelhouse, the Kerr grant stresses the importance of just really setting what that baseline is today. And then based on the uses, hospitality, we can quantify how many jobs the hospitality use would add, and then what those salaries are for a position. And we can really measure what that lift is going to be above the baseline that's been established already. We have great tools to do that using Treasury for demographic research. And then also the community outreach as well, informed baseline.
Oh, I want to get on with your next question, so.
Anything?
Get on.
So, if you can give us specific experience working with similar size projects and similar size communities, and that were success stories.
Yeah, one I would highlight, and it's kind of similar. Everybody's a little bigger in a lot of ways. The Port of Bellingham work, I think, does hit on a lot of similar. You know, they have real property as an opportunity site. There's a range of uses that we explored. We underwrote it, did the market analysis, the financial analysis, have identified what the opportunity looks like. Did a fair amount of public outreach and talked with a lot of different people. They have their own kind of political challenges with doing anything such a high profile waterfront location, so there's a lot of similarities to here. And then ultimately, we took that out to the market. So we had to take what we had learned in our opinions, and we had to translate that and convince others that that's in fact the case. And then spent, in that case, I know it's beyond the scope of this, but it took about a year to negotiate a purchase and development agreement with the developer, and would be implementing kind of the first phases of the mixed use downtown portion of the waterfront. So the scale is slightly different.
How about this one? It's a smaller scale. Port of Chelan on the Shaston Mill site. So Shaston, even smaller community in Kingston. They have the port had control of this property, old mill site, and been vacant for a long time. I think we started working on that in 2006 or 2005.
Yeah.
By the time we did a second look at it, it was at the recession, during the recession. So there wasn't a lot going on, but they had us take a look at the alternatives for that site and what it could be used for. The initial thought was either townhome residential development, which had its challenges. It's understanding the lay of the land. There's a train going past it, but it was waterfront, so it was great. Or industrial park, because it was zoned industrial. The second pass we looked at it, the wine industry was starting to take off, and the spirits. And so, you know, we said, what about a vineyard village type concept where you have the industrial aspects of it, but also a destination? Chelan's beautiful area, Shaston in particular, right on the ranch, was beautiful. And so, yeah, we did. We looked at, we actually went out to Prosser and looked at the Vendors Village there and get an idea of what it was like and see if it could translate to the site. Looked at the whole ecology of the wine industry and whether or not it would be supported. We also looked at the recreation industry.
Yeah,
its potential.
Outdoor recreation.
Yeah. And we talked to industry groups to understand what drove business decisions to locate in certain areas. You know, schools were actually a really big deal, and also breweries were really important because they like to have their beer, those workers. The short and long there is, at the time we finished the contract, like I said, it was around the recession, so it didn't really gain a lot of traction, but from this work, they had the baseline information to continue to market the property over time. They found someone to actually acquire the property, but I think the transaction closed a month or two ago. But they're going to be doing that wine destination project, so that's a success.
Follow-ups?
Do you have another question you need to get?
I have one more, but no, we're fine.
Okay. I want to make sure we get through your list.
Okay. So, obviously, we haven't selected anyone or negotiated a scope or anything else yet, but if you were selected, tell us your first recommended approach to kicking this project off. What would you do first?
Very first step for us is goals and objectives. I mean, it's, you articulated a lot of those. The curb grant provides some of that, but we want to have a conversation really with you and really start to dissect that and get much deeper into that piece. I mean, running in parallel with that, it's about pulling a lot of information. There's site-specific information, but as Matt said, there's lots of information. The goals and objectives also, I want to dance around a little bit. It's goals and objectives for the site and the grant and all that, but also it's goals and objectives for the board and how these assets fit into the board's broader mission. That's pretty cool. It's a jigsaw puzzle. You got a really interesting portfolio. How can these be leveraged? Yeah.
Any follow up to that? That's my last question.
Do you have someone on staff who is specifically tasked with the public outreach part?
No, we would do that. We find it's really helpful if you're down in the weeds and you're working on the project and you're worried about the financials, if you're thinking about whether we do this and that, that's what we do. And we'll stand up and facilitate the discussion with those sticky notes on stuff. We went to planning school for reasons. That's very good. I gotta give them money for that.
You don't use the colored dots.
Say cars?
Oh, you love the colored dots.
It's a colored dot.
Yeah. It's nice to meet Seattle.
On your bike.
And Carson will just move here too. We're going to bet him 4 months we'll bet him.
You're the people we need here. Us boomers are getting tired of doing all the public stuff.
Well, that is an interesting question because I would say we have like 35 different community groups in our unincorporated area who get things done. And 85 or 90% of them look like us. And only a handful look like you. I thought 17 years somewhere. How old is this guy? Because
42.
Yeah. I wasn't really asking your age. I was just telling you how people could react to who were these kids coming in and telling us what to do with Kingston. And so I'm just interested if you run into that kind of or
yeah, for 17 years.
That's why I grew a beard.
Imagine what it was like year one. all the time, actually. And I think the difference is a fair amount of it is the approach. And we don't tell people what to do. And that's the key. I mean, we're here to help shape and make things real and to be honest with people about what can and can't be done. So we're applying certain expertise, but we don't come in and say, like, you're doing a 5-story building, it's going to be right here, and I don't care what you do with the boat trailers. You know, it doesn't play well like that at all. And remember, as consultants, which we're from outside, you know, so really coming, listening, and then helping people is really the model. So you have to recognize you're always going to be different, whether it's because of how you look or your age or demographic or just because you're not from here. Like, you just can't be from here. And just appreciate the fact that you have for it. We did a project with the Housing Authority actually in Jackson, Mississippi several years ago with a design team, so a big production. I mean, there's no faking it. You know, I'm not from Mississippi. and so it was an intensive period of, like, you know, we're coming in to do our part of this bigger project, but never to presuppose that you have enough knowledge to tell them how it's going to be. And then to really work with them, and it's a process. But you get real comfortable with it.
Good.
Well, I think we've pretty much covered my questions. Do
I gave you guys a list of things that were suggested to us at for commissioners conference and the type of things we should walk away with somewhere in this process. And I don't know if that is beyond what the scope. Well, we're not talking about scope yet, really. But just I don't know how much to go down the list, but does that stuff seem feasible, or is there anything that looks like it's not feasible?
I think in order to define what the opportunity is, most of that stuff has to be covered, like zoning alternatives.
Yeah, yeah.
We've never been one to stay within the zoning boundaries when we're looking at a project. If the idea is a good idea, it happens to require zone change, especially working on the public side. We'll tell you what you need to change about the zoning to make it feasible. So
that's not an unreasonable expectation.
It's kind of a necessary part, actually. It's
that whole thing.
You can't really get to it. Public-private partnerships, for example, just as a quick alternative. We're looking at some of these properties, and the question is, okay, this is the development concept. Just kind of root out a scenario for the site, and we're going to say, well, who's going to do this piece? Let's say it does have live work in it. It's residential. That's not the importance of need to do that necessarily, which means we have to decide, okay, how would we go through, because we do a lot of transactional work, how would we take that through the process, and then what would that transaction look like? And then we bring that back to the economics, because that's going to have a material effect. So we're always thinking about how you implement, and so public-private structure, how's that going to work? Who's going to pay for what? What's the ownership going to look like? Is it a condominium, commercial condominium? Do I own this part because it's operational? And do I make everything above the podium? Is that a developer? And how does that relationship work? So those are things you kind of have to answer that question. Otherwise, it'd be a study and it would sit on a shelf. You wouldn't know what to do.
Well, thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
So we're going to have a little chat after you guys leave and see if we feel comfortable making a decision or not, and then we'll let you know. And we'll.
If there's any other questions or anything that comes to mind, don't hesitate to.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You didn't bring your bicycle?
Yes. I'm actually staying out at Camp Parsons Scout Camp this week with a group of boys. So
we were kidding about Monday.
Yeah. So I've been out here.
Oh, that's great.
It's young telecommuting. Millennial telecommuting from
exactly.
That's great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
I think we can record.
Yeah. Sure. Still a public meeting.
Yep.
Even though you're by ourselves.
What do you think?
Do you want to first talk and then to vote? Is that the way? Well, we're giving you advice, actually.
Yeah.
Because we didn't say we'd vote.
Right.
So
you're giving me advice on what to do.
Whether you asked for it or not.
Any one of these two you pick, I'll be a happy guy. Because we've got a lot of great, great talent that's been before us today.
I like Mary's question. It was kind of interesting because that's the people of the future. Mm-hmm. And that's the people we need to get here. And the development project has to be getting that bicycle guy to want to live here. And I kind of, until you mentioned it, I was kind of rung a bell with me that that's our target market. That's the future of Kingston if it goes right. Not a retirement community where, it's just old guys like us. Me.
You can say us. I'm okay with
yeah,
that.
But that, I appreciate you asking that question or raising that issue.
Yeah. They seemed very comfortable with it. I was really struck with how comfortable they were with that question.
I was kind of thinking, who are they talking to in the investment community or in the other communities that they deal with? They're talking to people like them, not people like me.
Right.
That was just an observation.
Bruce, any observations?
Well, I don't have a clear favorite between the two. I think that both of them had some strong points and some things where I marked down kind of weak answers. Neither one of them had really good experience working with similar size projects and similar size communities, I got to wondering, things must be slow in their field these days. If we would get
although the Chelan comment, it was great.
Chelan was good. He got plus marks for that.
Yeah, that.
And the property council got plus marks for the Olson property and wherever. I missed where that was, but again, it was good thinking on their feet for both of them. I was a little disappointed even when I tried to refocus them on, you know, the elevator speech idea, and I didn't use that term intentionally. These guys talked about how they would answer the question, but they never said, this is what I'd say. And that's what I was fishing for. And property counselor did a good job of, you know, they got carried away and went on, but the initial couple of sentences was a pretty good job of answering that hypothetical person. This group, too, I noticed a lot of hospitality-focused answers, which, in my mind, is not necessarily off the table. It's just way down on the list.
They don't know the baggage.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the problems is we gave them complete streets to review, and of course, so they're looking at Beckwith's stuff.
Yeah.
And so they think that's how we want to focus. So I understand
how that
came about.
Bias. Mm-hmm.
I liked everything these guys said about talking with the community. It was really different than I have ever heard anyone talk about it. But the whole idea that that's where you get the big idea generator, they're the testers and figuring out what can really be done with that, but that's a source of good ideas. And the whole conversation about talking to retailers and figuring out where's the gaps, what's complementary. I mean, I really liked at least how they explained in a way that I could get the role of these properties in catalyzing the rest of the community. And I got the same thing from Greg and John, but this felt sharper to me.
One thing I like them, property counselors really knows the community, having lived through all that sub-area plan stuff. So that was their strength. But these people took the project beyond the study. And I think that could be very critical in the step after the study's done. And I didn't get that same sense with property counselors. And I'm kind of thinking about, we got the study, then what? And I really felt comfortable with how they explained how they would lead us through the door to actually getting a development project. So that I thought that was a strength that I didn't see in property counselors.
Well, his comment about, we don't want to give you something that's going to be a big binder that sits in the shelf, really resonated with me. That it was like, we're going to show you how to take that information and get somebody in there.
Here's what we can make happen now, and here's how. That was what I got from them.
And we may need the resources like that to get the curb loan or to get investors. So we're maybe investing in a future study when they have experience about the project. And we can go back to, okay, now we got maybe a separate study or something. So that's kind of where I'm thinking. Not so strong on, I like the public engagement, but in terms of the planning thing, they didn't talk a lot about planning, but they did talk an awful lot about business.
Right.
And how you actually execute a business. And I've seen a lot of studies sitting on this stuff.
Yeah.
They're probably complete streets as well.
Actually, what they had to say about Rothland's dilemma, I thought was so right on, having some awareness of that environment and how they've helped that port frame what their task is. I think is I thought was good.
Yeah, they definitely emphasized the strength of their contacts and their outreach capabilities, and it's and I think, well, it's a good point. they clearly have that. I'm sure property counselors have some of that too, although we don't know how much. So that could have a lot of strength or a lot of value in the future.
It felt like property, this may just be saying what was obvious to all of us, but they've clearly been around the block with civic public agencies, CURB, blah, blah, blah. But when these guys talked about what CURB needed, they went right structurally to, you know, they need baseline, they need this. I mean, they understand data and how to use it and where to get it. And I was really intrigued. I wanted to ask six more questions about what do they mean about the statewide implications being attractive to CURB. Are these publishable reports? Is that how that becomes statewide? I just thought it was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting that Matt was with Jim during the presentation, which means Matt was probably there when we made our presentation.
Yes, right.
So I
wonder,
Hmm?
Yeah, I recognized him actually.
Yeah.
Insider information.
Yeah.
Okay, what do we need to do to help you?
Just tell me who you think we should go forward with a scope of work for.
Now, is that a decision we can make in the special meeting session, or
yeah,
do we have to wait until our general?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we don't pass a motion.
No.
We just give you advice.
You just give me advice. I need three advices, and then I'll execute a scope of work and contract with your approval.
I would have assumed that property counselors would have been my choice, but I'm more interested in what they come up with and the face that they would help us present. I would work on them.
Yeah, I started out with Heartland as my favorite after having read the proposals. And then I switched sides and I like property counselors better. But I think, all things considered, I'm back to Heartland as being, as nosing out property counselors. It's sort of like watching some of the Olympic swimming competition.
I'm Bruce and Mary. The big driver for me is I felt coming out of that, out of this, we'll be going forward. I felt a real sense that we'll come out of this with momentum in terms of actually getting a project done, which I'll be gone for, but you guys will be here for. Or that, you know, I just kind of felt that energy and focus, which doesn't come out when you're reading the proposals and things. So that's, like you said, the dating thing. There's a future in this relationship.
Yeah, farther than this. I mean, they were saying things that I went, boy, I could use them for this, this, and this in the future. So,
yeah, I had that sense too that I'd like them to get to know us,
yeah,
because.
Well, I concur. I don't have a vote, but if I had a vote, I'd have to say it. And I work with the other companies, and they're wonderful. But these guys, it still resonates with me that they're going to help us figure a way through the process.
Yeah.
That's so important. All right. I will develop a scope of work with them, put a contract back for you all on the 24th to review and approve or not. I will circulate the scope of work with you all through email so you can see how we're doing and any comments you might have.
Yeah, and they said they wanted a initial session, so there's probably some things that will get finalized in that session,
right,
if they're interested.
Sure.
You know,
great. Let's break for lunch and be back at 1 o'clock.